This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martirano. I hope you've found out about us by now. We're here on Saturdays. At this time, we're talking about the disease of addiction. The whole thing is sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, and we will have much more about them straight ahead. In addition to, you know, information about the disease of addiction, we want to leave you every day with information and maybe some guidance on the road to recovery, because in all of the bad news about the opioid epidemic or substance abuse in general, there is good news, and that good news is that millions of people manage to get sober. Millions of people manage to get sober. So we want to make sure that each and every program makes a specific point about that. We talk every week about this disease, and if you read anything about what's going on right now, or it's tragically happened to you or your family, you know the devastation of addiction. It's an equal opportunity killer. It literally and figuratively, it destroys lives across the board. And one of the casualties, one of the bigger casualties of substance abuse can be somebody's financial well-being. I mean, it almost always is just a major devastating effect on people's finances. So we thought we would take a specific look at after recovery, rebuilding one's life, and certainly a big part of your life is your finances, because whether we like it or not, money matters. So in order to figure that out, we went to our friendly neighborhood bank. And by neighborhood, I mean we're here in Ephrata, where Retreat's main campus is, and Akron, where the outpatient is, and reached out to our friendly bankers, and that would be a couple of guys from Ephrata National Bank. So I want to welcome them to the program and thank them for their time. Craig Rodenberger is the director of marketing. He is with us, and his colleague, John Stauffer. John is the senior retail officer for Ephrata National Bank. Guys, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Yeah, you didn't have to wear the coat and ties, though. I understand you're bankers. This is radio. I want to be just real quickly. How old is the bank? How long has the bank been in operation up here?
We've been in operation since 1881.
Wow.
So we're going on 137 years. So we're new kids.
Yeah,
on the
right.
Block.
Yeah, right. So before we get into the specifics of this, we want to make clear that neither one of you are particularly expert in substance abuse or treatment or recovery. You're here to talk about getting your financial life back in shape. And in that regard, while we're interested in people who are trying to remain sober and get their lives back together, the information you guys are going to share with us, is pretty much applicable to anybody that wants to, you know, figure out their finances, right?
Right. That's correct.
Is that the way it works? Okay, great. You know, guys, we have a lot of people in this program who, as I say, are in successful long-term recovery, and almost every one of them you talk to and learn about what this disease does to them. When they begin to get back on their feet and the cloud and the fog of substance abuse lifts, they're confronted with life. And that's really where sobriety kicks in, where it's one thing to stop using, another thing to build your life back up. And central to that is the mystery of finances, which most of them are completely at a loss for. They've gone through their money. They've often destroyed the finances of their family. They don't know how to open a checking account. So we're going to begin with some really ABC basic stuff. And let's start right there. For instance, why is it a good idea for anybody to have a checking account?
Sure. So sometimes if you go for a job, some employers will only offer direct deposit. In our electronic society today, some don't issue paychecks anymore. That's all done via direct deposit. So not having a checking account, you don't have the means to accept that deposit. So that's one reason it could be needed. Or if you don't have an account and you do get a paycheck, and you have no bank to go to, you could be charged a fee to cash that check. So even if that's the bank where the check was drawn from, there's times where you could be charged. Or if you go to Walmart or a check cashing service, there's typically a fee if you're not a customer.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Some people probably don't get jobs because they don't have bank accounts and they can't get a direct deposit.
It becomes tricky. So, you know, why do you have a checking account? When you think about it, just core foundational principles. First of all, it's a really bad idea to have a lot of cash on hand. So what your checking account is essentially your money management tool. You have money coming in, You have money going out. So what John talked about a little bit is you have money from an employer or from elsewhere, from other means coming in, whether it's direct deposit or whether somebody's still mm-hmm. physically handing you a paycheck. So checking gives you a good, safe place to put and manage and keep track of that money while you're then paying it out for different expenses. You know, you got to pay rent on your mm-hmm. apartment, or you got to pay your mortgage, you got to get groceries. So it also provides you with different vehicles to make those payments, whether you're still in the mode of writing a check because that's what your landlord wants, or you just want to take a debit card down to the 7-Eleven or Wawa or out here Turkey Hill to buy milk. So it's really a cash management tool so you can live your life.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of what I meant by this is generally good in a good practice for anybody, but it's particularly important for people in recovery because money can be a trigger. If you find yourself with some cash in your pocket, that cannot be a very good thing, particularly in the early stages of recovery. So you're right. You get yourself a checking account. If it's direct deposit, that's even better. Uh-huh. The money's there. You can manage it. So many people come in and literally don't know where to begin. They're intimidated. They think it's hopeless. Who's gonna let me open an account? Tell us, I'm walking into the bank. I mean, Craig, you mentioned before we went on the air, sometimes that can be banks can be intimidating.
Well, yeah, you know, a lot of banks' history was based in giving the impression that your money is safe here. Mm-hmm. And so banks were built trying to look very intimidating, as if to say, don't even think about coming here to rob us. But unfortunately, what that also does is it creates a level of intimidation for a customer. You know, I see a place lined with marble and all that kind of stuff. You go, gee, do I even belong here? And how are they going to treat me? And that is starting to change. I mean, a lot of banks are building branches that are less intimidating. But we certainly can appreciate how a lot of people would feel that way. But what they need to understand is that bankers are there to help them. And especially good ones, ones that understand and do their job well, they want to answer customers' questions and help them get situated in the right way.
John, what do people need to open a checking account?
Yeah, it's pretty simple to get started. You need a valid ID that is unexpired, hopefully showing either a current address or some documentation to show that current address. A small deposit to get the account started could be $50. Just to get the account open, and then we run a very basic background check. And many people get concerned and think that that's a credit check. It's not a true credit check. It's checking the information you've provided to make sure that that's valid information, and then checking somewhat of a database of other banks to see if there's outstanding monies that have been owed. So it's not checking to see, you know, have you been delinquent on a loan or do you have late payments? It's more of a basic background check.
I know, again, you don't have a special office that handles somebody who would come in with a background in substance abuse who's now in recovery. But so that wouldn't be even that background, someone who's been in and out of rehab and is now sober for 6 months or a year or something, that wouldn't be a stumbling block at all to get through this background check.
That in itself, no. It's not checking anything like that.
Yeah, you have to understand a lot of the background is confirming that you are who you say you are. Mm-hmm. You know, we have an obligation to customers because that helps ward off things like fraud and identity theft. So we have to identify the individual as who they say they are. Mm-hmm. There's anti-terrorist, anti-money laundering mm-hmm. variables we have to factor in, which comes out of – still goes back legacy stuff to 9/11 where laws were implemented to prevent a lot of that. Mm-hmm. So that unfortunately is necessary but adds to some of the intimidation factor because we have to ask this slew of questions now related to it.
Sure.
But it's not necessarily to dive into, like John say, and see if you have a 500 credit score. It's more just to say, okay, are you who you say you are, and some of the regulatory things we have to gather from it.
There are alternatives, though, for anybody who would have a problem with a background check, correct?
Right. So we offer somewhat of a second chance solution as well. It's in partnership through the United Way. It's called a bank on checking. So there's some limitations that are in place with that and some requirements involved in getting that type of account open. But if there are issues, we can mm-hmm. use that option.
When you say second chance, you mean, I guess, typically that might be somebody who's been through a bankruptcy or something?
Yeah, if you have difficulty getting through the checks and for whatever reason it comes back that we can't open the account, then this is a way, especially people who are struggling with their finances, to get a second chance, if you will. And it's something – so there's probably programs like it all over the place. The one we happen to use is through our United Way here. And, you know, United Way is kind of looking at the whole individual in ways that you are. So one of the things they've said is, okay, whether it's substance abuse or somebody else, somebody needs a checking account to move forward financially.
Right.
We need to have a mechanism to help them do that. So they've partnered with local banks here.
Well, so people should be very forthcoming when they sit down with the first person they meet in a bank trying to get this process going. They should tell them, look, some stuff may pop up. Is that going to be a problem? Do people typically do that, or do they wait for the flag to pop up?
You'd be surprised that more people do express, I think, that they are concerned of an issue.
Sure.
You know, it's – the situations vary, but, you know, our employees encounter individuals who come in to cash checks and ask them if they have an interest in opening an account with us, and oftentimes – they're very open to talk.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not suggesting that people in recovery should come in and right away say, by the way, I'm a former substance abuser.
No.
Right. But they should be frank with people. Look, I'm going to have some difficulty getting myself back on my feet financially. Can you help me out here?
Absolutely.
You guys are ready to do that.
And another thing I'll mention too is with people who might have trouble is prepaid cards that are becoming increasingly prevalent these days. And the way if you have trouble getting through a background check, banks are more comfortable giving those is because it's kind of – you're only using what you put into it. It's a preloaded card. With checking accounts, the concern with the bank is always overdrafts. Okay, so do I spend more money than what I have in my account? And why that's a concern for the bank is if we cover – the payment, you don't have enough money there for. We sort of gave you a loan without doing the proper loan evaluation. So that's a huge risk to the bank. So that's another reason why we go through this exercise. But when you have a prepaid card, you're only spending what's on the card, then that problem's eliminated. Yeah. So it's easier.
And again, it helps someone who has had problems in the past dealing with money. I mean, when they were abusing substances, all money was a vehicle to get high.
Right.
So there wasn't any prudence involved in any of that. So this is a great way, not only to get yourself back on your feet financially, but also get a handle on your behavior, and that will support your sobriety. This is great. Craig Rodenberger and John Stauffer from Effort and National Bank are with us. We're talking about rebuilding your financial life after. Treatment for substance abuse. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. We have more. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. My name is Steve Martorano. We're talking about a specific area of rebuilding your life while you're in recovery after substance abuse treatment, and that is getting your financial life back on track, which most often has been devastated by this disease. John Stauffer, who is Senior Retail Officer for Effort and National Bank, is with us, as is his colleague, Craig Rodenberger. Sorry about that, Craig, earlier. Craig is the Director of Marketing for the bank here in Lancaster County. So, guys, a person comes in, and they don't have a lot of money, and they're thinking, well, you know, what am I even doing here? What are the couple of things they have to know about concerning fees and maybe some problems that might arise in that regard?
Sure. So I think the most important thing is simple balancing and maintaining of a checkbook. So we find with people of all ages and all backgrounds that's where people seem to struggle is managing the funds that they have there and keeping track of what expenses they are using. So we really try to work with people to show them how to record things in a checkbook to keep an accurate balance.
So you will do that.
We will take time to sit and work with somebody if they're not sure how to do it.
It's important for adults to hear that because they think, well, I'm 30 years old or I'm 25, I should know how to do that. But you'll sit them down and say, look, you gotta know how to balance a checkbook, right?
We will at Effort and National. It's important to understand not every bank will. Some have varying degrees of the lengths that which they'll go to sit down and help customers with that, but we'll definitely do it. And the other thing that's important for customers to know is that, and I understand, you know, we're talking about getting back on your financial feet, so this might not be possible, but if you have the means, there's some good software out there like Quicken, like Mint, that will help you balance your checkbook. You can download account information from your bank's online banking into it, so you don't have to manually record everything, and that also helps you from missing certain things. But it's really important to understand why you want to keep track of things in your checkbook and not just look at the slip of paper that comes out of the ATM with your balance on it, because you might have items outstanding that you've essentially made a promise to pay someone. You know, you write a check, you're promising to pay someone. Well, if that check hasn't come in yet, you're going to think you have more money than you really do. So that's when surprises happen, and that's when we then have customers in front of us asking us to waive the overdraft fee they were charged, which we do from you know, not in many cases. But those surprises where, oh, yeah, I wrote somebody that check. It was their birthday. They waited 2 weeks to cash it, and I forgot that money was promised to somebody, and now it's out of my account, and I'm overdrawn.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm old enough, as you can tell by looking at me, to remember when, you know, if you were conscientious enough, you actually filled all this out with a pen mm-hmm. in the back of your checkbook mm-hmm. And had the key. And my wife, thank God, is good with money, because I don't think I've ever balanced a checkbook in my life. But now you can do it. Most people do it electronically, right?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. What about things like – I'm sorry.
I was going to say, you know, at Effort International, we have an app that people can download on their phone and be looking at things constantly. And most banks do have that. So the availability to see things on a regular basis is very simple, but it's still very important, like Craig said, for you to maintain your own records, because when you've issued a check or payment, that doesn't come out of your account the minute you write the check. It's once the other person mm-hmm. cashes the check, it could take days to weeks, depending on how long that process takes.
And the other thing you have to think about is not just overdrawing your account, but if you're in a checking account that has a minimum balance you have to maintain to avoid a monthly fee, you want to make sure you're tracking that accurately so you don't dip below that level, because it's not an average. Mm-hmm. It's not if you stayed above it on average for the month. It's as soon as you go beneath that threshold, bing, you get whacked with a monthly maintenance fee. Now, our advice would be go to a bank that doesn't have a monthly maintenance fee, and we happen to fall into that category. But there's others out there. Sure. You know, shop around for that.
Well, what's important for people listening to this who may have family members, or it may have happened to them personally, to understand is that these are things you can't be intimidated about. There are no dumb questions to ask somebody when you walk into a bank. So it's important to go. Well, if I open a checking account, do I have to keep a certain amount of money into it? Am I charged anything? How does that work?
Yeah, and I'll tell you why that's so important, because it's like anything else, right? You deal with it every single day. So as bankers, we deal with this every day. And what happens is you start to assume everybody knows the same things you do, because you're just mm-hmm. doing it all the time. So I think as bankers, it's really helpful when people do ask those questions, because it allows the elimination of just assuming that people know what we think they know. And you know, we work hard to ask questions, but still, there's always those things you can never predict, or you always assume incorrectly. So I think we personally love it when customers – the more questions a customer can ask, the better relationship they're going to have with their bank, the more they're going to understand, and the less opportunity for miscommunication or misunderstanding later on.
Some of the notes you guys provided have some terms – I mean, I'm not familiar with overdraft fees. I certainly am. What's an inactive fee, John?
An inactive fee can be if you're not using the account for a certain period of time, that you may get charged a fee for not using it. Some banks have fees like that, some don't, so it's important to find that out up front and look at a notice or a fee schedule to see what is charged. Sometimes it's only charged if you're inactive and below a certain balance. So
again, we're back to that.
Right.
When you sit down with somebody, find out how it works. Again, as I said at the beginning of the program, folks who are in recovery and trying to maintain sobriety are completely unfamiliar with the entire process, and it can be daunting for them. So this is great stuff. It's also valuable for anybody else listening to it. We're going to take another break here now, and then return to the subject of your financial well-being in recovery with our two executives from Effort and National Bank. And in the next couple of segments, I think we're going to get into the even not thornier, but more perhaps intimidating questions, two of which come immediately to mind is, one, building savings, which for people in sobriety may be the last thing on their minds. How am I going to save money? But the other one is rebuilding credit, which I think is probably the key to maybe this whole thing, because if I said money mattered, credit seems to make the world go round. So we're talking about getting back on your financial feet after having going through a substance abuse situation. This is Recovery Radio. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. We're here on Saturdays talking about the disease of addiction and the road to recovery. Today, it's about the financial road back, because this disease can just wreak havoc, not only on the substance abuser, but their family can be devastated by this. And our guests from Effort and National Bank are filling us in. Before we get back to their discussion, a reminder that Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers is the sponsor of the program. I say this every week, but I'm so proud of it, I want to keep repeating it. They pay the freight. Is this an infomercial? Are we here to tell you this is the only place you can get treatment? No, of course not. But I would be remiss to not point out that Retreat is a world-class operation. Check them out. Their reputation speaks for itself. They have helped lots and lots of people. I'm going to give you their phone number. And again, I say this every week, and I mean it sincerely. I hope you never have to use this phone number. But if this disease visits you or your family, you're not going to see it coming. And you're going to have to make some very tough decisions under extraordinary circumstances. So I give you the phone number. You can call this number. You'll talk to a real person. You can ask any questions about anything about the disease of addiction or treatment you're getting now or anything you've heard on the program. They will answer your questions. If they can help you, then they will help you. But they will answer your questions. So here's the number, 855-859-8808. Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Their facilities are here in Lancaster County. The outpatient facility in Akron, the main campus, the residential campus is in Ephrata, but they have facilities in the West Palm Beach as well. 855-859-8808, Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Back to our guest, John Stauffer and Craig Rodenberger from Ephrata National Bank. They're demystifying the whole process of getting your financial life back in order as you maintain sobriety after substance abuse. So, guys, that was a great, you know, primer, the ABCs of how do you walk into a bank, and demystify the whole process of opening an account and going through background checks and finding out what fees. Thanks. I appreciate that, because a lot of people don't understand all that. The bigger issue, I think, for people in sobriety and one that doesn't manifest itself right away is, okay, it would be nice now to maybe save some money. And then further, I want to get my credit back. My credit is important. So let's talk about those two areas. Except for the obvious, but from a banker standpoint, what's the importance of saving money?
Well, I think the most important thing is it creates a buffer when the unexpected happens. So emergencies happen, all kinds of life happens, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of those life events have a financial ramification to it. So it's important to get a buffer in place so that when something like that does occur, you're not selling something, you're not borrowing from friends or family or on a credit card, because that can, especially the credit card route, if you've built your credit back up and now you're borrowing more than you can pay back, you can get yourself back in trouble pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to build that buffer and in case something happens.
Yeah. And again, I point out that that's good advice for all of us. For someone in long-term recovery, it's a building block. It helps you maintain a sort of rigor to get your life back together. It's nice to see some money going into the bank that's yours, and it's set there for all the reasons Craig just mentioned. So, John, how do you get somebody started? Would that be something that you would, as a banker, would say to somebody? Or are you interested in opening a savings account? How would that come up?
Sure. So when we open a new account for somebody, or even talk to our existing customers, we talk about their situation and look for opportunities that can help them improve themselves. And I think this is one area that we're talking about, like you said, that affects everybody, not just those in recovery, but really the majority of Americans do not have enough savings to be prepared for these types of emergencies. So there's many ways that you can get this started. We can open a simple savings account, usually with as little as $100. And then we try to suggest to people to put themselves on some type of plan. There's many ways you can go about doing that. You could If your employer offers direct deposit, you can have it automatically go into the savings so that you're essentially paying yourself first before putting the money into your checking to pay your bills. You can set up an automatic transfer on a set basis from your checking account if you want to. If you're paid weekly or biweekly, decide what amount you're able to save each pay and have that automatically come out of your checking right into the savings account so that it's already there.
You know, that phrase, pay yourself first, you hear a lot, and we don't do it often enough. It's a wonderful idea, isn't it? You just pay yourself first.
It can be, if you can establish the discipline to do that, it can be very impactful. And especially so when you're kind of starting out and building back up again, you almost have a golden opportunity to do that because you haven't formed any habits yet. So if you can build the habit right away of putting that money aside in the savings that you haven't spent before, then you're not going to miss it.
Well, what's great about this topic, I think, is in general, as we said, it's a general primer on what's good financially for everybody. But with regard to people who are trying to maintain sobriety, discipline is very important. They've led a completely undisciplined life, the drug having taken over everything. And this is a way to, again, one foot in front of the other, and this is, incredibly important. So as I hear you guys talk about, banking in general and people coming in, is it fair to say that, and I don't think people think of bankers as financial planners. I mean, there's a function of what you do that is financial planning, right, for people?
Absolutely. We try to work with them, coach them to be able to make the decisions that they need to make and to look at their personal situation and see how we can help them to better themselves, achieve their financial goals. So whether it be saving to purchase a home, a car, whatever their personal needs and desires are, we try to tailor our conversation to be able to help them.
Craig, you agree people don't look at bankers as financial planners? People make a lot of money calling themselves financial planners, right? Right.
Well, they do. And, that can be a tricky term. And it's not one that you can just throw around loosely because they're certified financial planners, right? And there's a legal element to that. So we don't fall into the certified financial planner category, although we do have people who can do that on staff that we can make referrals to. But no, you're right. I mean, people sort of look at the bank as, well, I open my checking account there, I walk in, walk out, I tap the ATM machine, I get a loan, and that's kind of what my bank is for. But we can actually do more than that because we can provide some helpful advice and whether it's how to balance your checking account, like we talked about earlier, or how to build credit,
or just saving, yeah, saving some money. Okay, let's get down to brass tacks here. Now, it's generally known that Americans don't save enough. There's a lot of reasons for that. One is that it's tough to find places to save money. I mean, that's going to give you some kind of return that makes sense. What are some of the vehicles that people who want to put a little money away can?
Sure. So getting started, your basic vehicle within the bank would be a savings account. So that's going to be, of the savings options, the lowest required minimum balance to open. It's completely FDIC insured at a bank like Effort National, so it's there and available. It's a safe place versus keeping it at home or
safer
keeping
than
it
the
somewhere,
mattress, right?
You know, when you talk about, like we said earlier, with keeping cash, and that's why you would want to have a checking account as a place to keep that money instead. You know, it's not accessible at home. It's safer in the bank.
Craig, explain a little bit about online savings accounts through the bank. Is that just an electronic way of saving money?
Yeah, so there's a couple ways you can skin that cat. So just kind of revisiting what we talked about with how you maintain the discipline, the best way to maintain the discipline is to automate your savings. Make it so you don't even have to do it. It just happens on its own. So whether that's having an employer deposit part of your paycheck directly to savings, or whether it's going into a bank's online banking account, and you can set up transfers on the same date, the same time every month. So if you just want to automatically have money go from your checking to your savings, maybe you do it every payday and your online banking knows, okay, it's time to move money from Craig's checking to his savings account. or have the bank manually set that up for you. So there's, like I said, a couple ways you can skin that cat, but the best way to do it is to automate it, to establish that habit and that discipline.
There's some obvious safety factors there in that regard as well. I know that we didn't specifically ask you to deal with something like this, but I'm wondering, you guys monitor activity on accounts all the time, right? I mean, what I'm thinking about is someone in the grip of this disease can go through their money and anybody else's money they can get their hands on. And generally, that's the way it happens. Families go into deep debt, crushing debt because of the disease of addiction. Are you in a position to let people know that there's some crazy activity in your accounts? Or would that be something that the bank would automatically do?
We do have monitoring in place that tracks what you would call abnormal activity for a customer. So there are times where we or somebody from like our fraud area would be able to reach out to a customer and say, you know, we're trying to verify transactions or verify mm-hmm. activity to know and be sure it was the customer that did that.
The key is really, I think what you're saying is if you're on the account with someone, so let's say I'm in recovery and somebody co-signed my – or is a joint account, or maybe it's my wife, maybe right. it's a parent, maybe it's – name the situation. So there are also ways that both individuals, as long as you are on the account, you can have access to what's going on in the account. And if you want to go online and open up online banking with your bank to view that, you can do that. But also what a lot of online banking programs allow you to do is set up alerts. So you get notified via text or email every time a withdrawal is made, every time a deposit's made. If you get below a certain minimum balance threshold, you get an alert. So that way, again, automating it. Make it automatic so you don't have to think about it. You just get notified that something's going on.
So if families are dealing with this in their lives at a bank like yours, if they want to go in and say, look, he's doing well, she's doing well, but we've got to keep an eye on these finances. I want to set up these procedures, you're there. That can be done too.
Yes, but you have to be on the account. You can't right. if you have no relationship yes. on the account because mm-hmm. There's privacy issues.
Getting your financial world together as you maintain sobriety. That's the topic of this edition of Recovery Radio, and we have more with our friends from Effort and National Bank straight ahead. Don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano is my name. We're here on Saturdays, 6 o'clock, talking about the disease of addiction and the road to recovery. It's sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. We wanted to get some financial advice because that's a big part of pulling everything back together as you maintain sobriety, and that's getting your financial world firmly under your feet. To that end, we have been speaking with Craig Rodenberger and John Stopher of Effort and National Bank. The final piece here, I think, John, is somebody who has been through this disease of addiction has almost invariably destroyed their credit, maybe their family's credit as well. Take us through the process of rebuilding one's credit.
Sure. So the first thing I would say is you do need to understand where you're at as far as your credit, and you can go through a site called annualcreditreport.com. It's www.annualcreditreport.com and monitor your credit for free. There are services available that you can pay for, but you're able to get free information right from that site. And
free information,
right?
Incidentally.
Okay. Right.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
And they're not going to give you your score, but they're going to show you what is on your credit. Through verification of who you are, you can get in to see through the three different credit reporting agencies your information. So then as far as rebuilding it, as we just talked about savings, that is important to do before the rebuilding of credit, because many of the things that you would want to do to rebuild your credit, you would need to have security for. So that could be a secured credit card, or a loan that is secured by money that you already have.
What's a secured credit?
A secured credit card is where you basically give the credit card company, say, $500. Then you're granted a $500 credit limit. You use that card just as you would any other credit card. You get a monthly bill with a payment that is due. You could pay it off. You could pay only the minimum payment, but you'll pay that just as you would any other credit card, and they're holding that $500 as the collateral, so to speak, for your credit limit.
Well, that sounds good. Is there any downside to something like that?
No, it's really the avenue for people who either have no credit, so you know, a young person who has no established credit, or somebody looking to rebuild their credit, the opportunity to be able to do that where they might not be able to get a credit card otherwise. So typically after a period of time, you know, demonstrating good behaviors and the credit is starting to be rebuilt, then that credit card could be converted to a regular credit card.
Regular unsecured credit
card. And then you get your initial money back.
Right. Oh, is that right? So that's the first step. Right. You've got your you've got your finances a little bit, and you got maybe a couple of bucks that you need to either put into the savings account. It would make more sense at that point to get one of these cards and start getting a reputation for someone who pays their bills.
It would be a first step. Right. So I think secured card would be the optimal way to go. If that's not possible, you could try like a retail store card. Like if you go to Lowe's, they're always offering you a Lowe's card at checkout, or Home Depot card at checkout. And they're a little easier because the credit standards on those aren't as high as a typical credit card. So that could be an option. If you can take out a small personal loan, maybe you're buying a vehicle of some sort and you can get somebody who has good credit to co-sign for you, that could be another option.
Let me ask you how that works. If someone co-signs in a situation like that, how does that affect my credit score? Does it have any negative impact on it?
Could.
It potentially could. So the co-signer is basically
guaranteeing
the loan. So what they're saying is, If you as the borrower do not make the payments, I'm willing to make the payments.
So while it may be necessary to get a cosigner, it's preferable not to, so that you get the credit for timely payments.
Well, you would both get the credit for timely payments. What the cosigner has to understand is they are signing a legal document. Mm-hmm. So if the primary doesn't pay, the cosigner needs to pay. And so that gets back then to having an ability to track and monitor, because where we've seen where sometimes cosigners get in trouble is they're blindsided. They didn't know the primary wasn't paying. Mm-hmm. And then they're seeing their credit report and that loan is behind. So that's what cosigners, you know, and we appreciate everybody's good intentions to want to help, but they have to understand what their obligations are.
This is a thorny issue for people in families where this disease has occurred, because they have destroyed the confidence and trust that you would normally, associate with a family member. So, finally, let me ask you this, and maybe a tough one. With regard to somebody who now, you know, they're working now, they're sober, paycheck coming in, they've got an account, maybe they've got a little savings. Would you advise somebody in a situation like that to lean more towards the savings concept with their money, or with building credit? At the end of the day, John, what would you just see?
I would say that I would do the savings first and then work to build the credit. So the savings is important because now you've demonstrated the discipline, you know, and then you have the options to use that savings to start to build your credit. Like I said, through the secured credit card, or even like at Effort International, we offer a loan that could be secured by money that you have in the bank. So,
and that would be a great way to do both things.
Right.
Right. So you save and get your credit.
Absolutely.
Back.
Exactly. Yeah. So you've through the savings, you've demonstrated that you can establish that discipline, and then that's a step towards the credit.
I would agree with John. I mean, savings – what the problem with savings is, it's always – and I think why Americans have trouble saving is, A, immediate gratification. We sort of live in a now society, and it's just so darn easy to put it off till later and to say, oh, well, once I get this, there's always that if then. If I do this, then I'll start to save. So eliminate the if and say, I'm just going to start to save, especially if you have that credit card in your hand and you haven't started saving. It's just a swipe.
It's too easy to spend.
Yep.
Guys, thanks so much. This is an important issue for people in recovery and their families as well. I would recommend to anybody listening to do what we did. When we wanted to find out more about it on the program, we went to our friendly neighborhood bank. Effort has a branch right across the parking lot here. So I said, well, you know, let's reach out to those guys. You can do that as well. And don't be intimidated about it. You will not only get your life back, but you'll maybe develop some good skills with regard to discipline that can only help your sobriety. Gentlemen, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
And enjoy the rest of your weekend, folks. Look for us next Saturday on Recovery Radio. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.